With me now on Fresh Air is Seymour Hersh, author of the new book, The Price of Power, Kissinger and the White House. Hersh is one of America's foremost investigative reporters. In 1970, he broke the story of the My Lai massacre and was recognized with the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. In 1974, he won a Polk Award for his reporting on the secret bombing in Cambodia. The following year, he won another Polk Award for his stories on the CIA's domestic spying and the CIA's role in Chile. He won his fourth Polk in 1974 for his investigation of former CIA officials who were selling arms to Libya. Hersh worked with the New York Times from 1972 to 1979. He left the paper to write his book on Kissinger. He's currently the national correspondent for The Atlantic. Hersh's new book, The Price of Power, Kissinger in the White House, is based on approximately 1,000 interviews, mostly with men and women who worked in the American government during Nixon's first term. Neither Kissinger nor Nixon consented to be interviewed for the book. The Price of Power is a study of Kissinger's use and abuse of power during the SALT talks, the Vietnam War, and his other international negotiations. The book also chronicles Kissinger's power plays within the Nixon administration. Hersh concludes that Nixon and Kissinger tried to control foreign policy themselves. He writes, quote, "In the end, as in the beginning, Nixon and Kissinger remained blind to the human costs of their actions. The dead and maimed in Vietnam and Cambodia, as in Chile, Bangladesh, Biafra, and the Middle East, seemed not to count as the president and his national security advisor battled the Soviet Union, their misconceptions, their political enemies, and each other." The Price of Power is published by Summit Books. Seymour Hersh, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
A lot of people, even Nixon's detractors, would say, well, he really blew it on domestic policies, but you have to give him credit in the area of foreign affairs. He did end the war in Vietnam. He opened up relations to China. It seems to me that your book is in part an attempt to disprove that, to say that he blew it in international affairs, too.
It all started, I was working at the New York Times, and I was dragooned in the Watergate, reluctantly, I have to say, after Woodward and Bernstein began breaking all those wonderful stories 10, 11 years ago. And as I got into Watergate, there was this incredible dichotomy that we all accepted, which was there was the bad Nixon we all learned to love and hate on the White House tapes and the various schemes that he attempted to get away with, the cover-up in the Watergate scandals, et cetera, the criminal acts. And then there was the good Watergate, the good Nixon, rather, the notion that Nixon could spend hours talking about who to lay the blame on in Watergate and where to raise $1 million in cash, and that would be wrong, et cetera. That kind of conversation could go on half the day, and the door would open, and out would roll Mitchell, Dean, Haldeman, or whoever, and in would walk Henry Kissinger. And the conception was, the perception really was that, in essence, violin music would break out and Nixon would become a foreign policy savant, the man who was famous for having said on one tape, "I don't give an expletive deleted about the lira," when the Italians devaluated the dollar. And he and Nixon would have a private seminar at the graduate level, at Harvard, on foreign policy. What can I say except that, if you believe that, you believe in the tooth fairy. And the fact is that my basic premise was that human nature, having, not that I'm a great observer of it, but having seen people behave in power, there's just no way, it just couldn't have been. But, it was, the incredible thing about it really is that Kissinger's diplomacy with the press corps was truly astonishing, truly astounding, and a little frightening. Anyway, my assumption was that if I started to talk to people, I would find out what happened, and that whatever I found would really approximate, in terms of the ethics involved, exactly what we all knew about Nixon and the way he behaved in Watergate and domestic activities. The Southern strategy, if you remember all that, the blatant appeals to the Southern racist strategy conception, and I was right. It was worse than I thought, I'll be honest, but I was right.
Did you think that by the time the book was published, people might think of Kissinger as a has-been since he no longer had an official place in American government?
When I was first approached to do the book by a very fine publisher, Jim Silverman, who was my editor at Random House when I did books on My Lai, he'd gone to set up his own little house inside Simon & Schuster, the new wave of the future, small houses and big publishing firms. He first approached me in 1977 to do this book when I was at the Times, and I said no because I thought Kissinger was out of power and he would disappear. A few years later, we talked again, and this time it was time to do it because he hadn't disappeared. His power was still immense. If the Shah was in trouble, it was Kissinger who was brokering it. Kissinger's ability to wield the press, push him around, was still as good as ever. And it also seemed clear that this whole notion of great diplomatic triumphs that emerged out of the Nixon era, the notion of foreign policy successes, it was clear that, for example, there was no settlement in the Middle East, despite all of this talk about Kissinger bringing a settlement to us during the shuttle diplomacy, because you couldn't solve any of the problems. You cannot solve any of the problems in the Middle East without taking the Palestinian issue into account. It was also clear that the SALT process, which had been so much ballyhooed and oversold by the White House, SALT I did not lead to SALT II. In fact, I make a very strong and detailed and probably overkill article, and not overkill just in the sense of the demands I put on readers. A long 200 pages of the 700-page book deals with 150 pages, deals with SALT, and I describe how I think the SALT process got butchered by Nixon and Kissinger. They were out-negotiated. They lied about what they failed to accomplish in the talks with the Soviet Union in the spring of 72, and they left a legacy of distrust, which ended up in costing us a chance for further disarmament. So if the Middle East wasn't a success and the SALT talks weren't a success, what about Vietnam? And I'm here to say that if you think pulling the American troops out, changing the color of the corpses, getting rid of the black and white corpses and leaving Asians to die, if you think the Nixon-Kissinger peace in 73 was a settlement, once again, you know, you're in trouble. It wasn't a settlement. It wasn't an honorable settlement. It was just a way of keeping the war going, only making it more palatable at home. And then you turn finally to China, and upon looking at China very hard, you discover that the China certainly was the high point of the Nixon-Kissinger administration, but it was Nixon's policy. And it wasn't all so good either. The motives behind China weren't as altruistic as one might think. They were basically were very shrewd re-election motives, which is all right. We don't no objection, but that wasn't the way it's been packaged to the American people and the world. It's been packaged as this great innovative thing. In fact, the Chinese were more than anxious for it and were pushing for it, and Nixon picked up an obvious cue, to his credit, and he ran with it in terms of arranging China, the opening to China, so that he could have a summit in Peking with live television, arriving right on the, you know, right at the peak time for American interest, you know, early in the morning here, late in the afternoon there, for the Today Show and all the other network shows to pick him up as he landed. You know, the Chinese set up a special satellite for that stuff, and you know, they went out of their way to give Nixon what he wanted because they got what they wanted too. It was very shrewd bargaining. What I'm saying is, the emperor has no clothes. That what we all consider to be the great foreign policy accomplishments, we're really left with an opening to China, whose long-term goal certainly is important. I would argue also that the great concept of triangular diplomacy, which Kissinger and Nixon bandied about in those years, the idea of affecting the Russian behavior by the United States relationship with the People's Republic of China, has just been so much words that the triangular diplomacy really was, I guess, a paper tiger in the Chinese phrase. Largely because it certainly didn't prevent China. Has been the China that Nixon Kissinger visited in 72, the Peking was a Potemkin village. China was in real trouble. China had gone through the Red Guards issue, the crisis. China had internal problems galore, political problems. Mao's whole tenure was very unsure. They just had the revolution with Ling Piao. I'm sure some of you people know your audience knows what I'm talking about. I assume if this audience doesn't, we're all in trouble. The economic harvests were way down. There was party and problems inside the party. Party discipline was lax. The military was quite weak. In no way did the Chinese pose any significant military threat to the Russians, and the Russians had behaved appropriately. I mean, they weren't worried about it. They did what they had to do. If they had to go in Angola, they went. I wouldn't say it's appropriate, but they did what our relationship with China, triangular diplomacy, did not stop the Russians from doing anything. So that's been oversold too. And so what you have are all these gimmicks and stratagems and that ended up being described by the press as great triumphs. And, you know, I the word is fulsome. Some of the reporting actually, you know, got obnoxious, particularly in Moscow and Peking during the summits. Anyway, that's more than you want to know. But that's
Seymour Hersh is my guest, the author of the new book, The Price of Power, Kissinger and the Nixon White House. You paint a picture of Kissinger and Nixon trying to keep all the foreign policy power to themselves and get it out of the hands of the other powers of the administration and the State Department. How did they do it? What were their techniques for keeping the power, as much power as possible, between the two of them?
Well, the basic goal, of course, was the basic problem they had was that their real enemies, of course, were not the Russians and the Chinese, our classical enemies, you know, I guess in political terms, but the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. They got and that was they were in a hot war in terms of their own administration. The concept was, I guess, I don't know what the origin of it was. Clearly, it's Nixon's. You know, Kissinger is the tail. You know, really not wagging the dog either. He's the tail. Nixon really is the strong man of the two in terms of concept. Kissinger is the ultimate toadier. So when I talk about Kissinger, you can't forget Nixon. Nixon's pulling the strings in the background. He's very good at that. The goal was, for some reason, Nixon emerged from the Eisenhower years where he was vice president with an incredible distrust of the bureaucracy. I don't know the origins of it, as I said. The goal was in 68 when Nixon won, was he was going to take everything. He was going to run all foreign affairs. Nothing was going to be going to take place without Nixon. And if there were triumphs, they would be Nixon's. There were to be no triumphs for the Secretary of State, Bill Rogers, and no triumphs for Mel Laird, the Secretary of Defense. They were to be submerged. The beating up of Bill Rogers began immediately, and Kissinger eventually got criticized pretty heavily for it within 2 or 3 years because of his treatment of Rogers. But again, you have to understand whatever he did with Nixon's at Nixon's request. And Nixon's relationship with Rogers is another mystery and anomaly. Nixon apparently had a good relationship with him in the Eisenhower years when Rogers was Attorney General. He knew nothing about foreign policy. He wasn't very energetic, although he's a perfectly bright, decent man. In normal conservative Republican terms, you know, his politics aren't what I would respect particularly, but given for what the party and what that wing of the party, he was perfectly responsible and could have had some good political instincts. Instead, they just chewed him up, and he let them chew him up. Cutting out the State Department was what we did for a living, as I quote one of Kissinger's aides as saying. Mel Laird was tougher. He was a former politician, a former congressman, had been around Congress for a long time. Laird was considered to be the ultimate enemy, I guess. One of the aides described Mel Laird. Kissinger described, I thought Mel Laird's last name, Mel's last name was Crook, he said, but Kissinger kept on calling him that Crook, Laird would work around the White House. And what they did is from the moment they got in, this was their policy. Kissinger began almost immediately with the concept that's simply known as back channels. What they did is they simply set up private relationships with everybody, with the Russians, with the Chinese, all of the serious negotiations, with the Vietnamese, the secret talks in Paris. All of the serious negotiations went on privately between Kissinger and his counterpart in Peking, Moscow, or Saigon, or Hanoi. Without the State Department being cut in on any sort of level, or the Secretary of Defense. I mean, I'm talking about serious military options even were discussed, and without the Secretary of Defense, military planning went on without Mel Laird knowing about it. And the actual way it worked is a senior ambassador would roll into town for a routine series of home leave, and he would pay the obligatory call on the Secretary of State and see the President for 10 minutes, as most American senior ambassadors do when they're home for leave. Nixon and Kissinger would have a little, so what I describe as a dog and pony show worked out. One of the two would make an offer to the ambassador to double-cross his Secretary of State and start reporting privately to the White House. They would set up a special channel, usually run by the CIA or the National Security Agency, which has its own separate means of communication. No copies to the State Department or the Pentagon. The ambassador, if he had anything important to say, was to get in touch directly with Kissinger and send a coded message. And many of the ambassadors did it. Others said no. Paul Nitze, who was the ambassador, was an aide to the ambassador to the disarmament, the military, the disarmament talks on the strategic arms limitations with the Soviet Union. Nitze was they made a pass at Nitze, and he was offended. He said, "I couldn't double cross the man I'm working for. I have to work with him." And Nixon immediately, I describe as Nitze recounted it to me. Nixon immediately backed off and said, "Okay, well, Paul, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. You misunderstood me. You know, that's the way they worked it. They tried, and if the guy had integrity, why, he was dismissed, and it didn't happen. If the guy had less integrity, which many, you know, it's not a question of even integrity. I guess the smart, bureaucratic, politically wise thing to do if you're a young ambassador wanting to get ahead is to do what the president asks you to do. I mean, that's just the way it is. Nitze happened to be older with more standing and also quite a gentleman, although he's another conservative. And what I have to say quickly, is that the whole business of titles gets very confused in my mind, because I no longer worry about whether somebody's a Democrat, a liberal, or conservative, a Republican, a left, or righty. I basically look at it in terms of whether or not they have personal integrity, which is the critical issue for me. Anyway, that was one mechanism for drawing him in, use of the back channel. The Russians were more than delighted to work directly with Nixon and Kissinger. Occasionally there were mistakes. Occasionally some ambassador would learn something, or some Russian diplomat would mention to his counterpart that there were talks going on that the Secretary of State did not know about. But by and large, they managed to seize the power.
You said that the successful negotiations in Vietnam aren't as successful as they may appear. And you indicate that several times there was the option of ending the war, of ceasing bombing, of having good negotiations, and that was passed over because the time didn't seem quite right, that it would have had a negative impact on Kissinger and Nixon's power within the administration or within the upcoming election. What were some of those opportunities that they missed for self-serving reasons?
You mean to end the war, to get a settlement
yeah.
more quickly? I would argue that, look, when it comes to Vietnam, obviously as somebody who's involved in My Lai and reporting on it for years at the New York Times and elsewhere, I'm a little obsessive about it. So when I started all of this, I think the driving engine for me is Vietnam. It was a bad war and continued for bad reasons. And if I'm right about what I'm saying about Vietnam, this policy I'm describing in my book is so totally at odds with everything we've read, everything that's been put out. It's as if white were black or black were white. The colors have no significance. It's just, it's sort of, everything's turned inside out. And if I'm right, it does seem to me to raise so many profound questions about the information we get about from our media, from our leaders, not only obviously in Vietnam, but elsewhere, for example, in Central America, et cetera. I think that's the whole point of the book in a way. That it's sort of a warning that, look out, folks, things aren't what they seem. The policy in Vietnam as I see it, and I did a lot of work in this area, another aside, I was able to go to Hanoi in 79 and visit with the senior officials there, including Win Co Thach, who's now the foreign minister and a member of the Politburo, who was very active in the talks as the chief deputy or chief aide to Lê Đắc Tô. And we spent, I can't tell you how many dozens of hours going over the talks. And I got access to Nixon's cables and the Vietnamese cables from there. I eventually, a few years later, thank God, it takes a long time to do a book like this, and it pays off sometimes. After about 3.5 years, finally, Nguyen Van Thieu, through an aide, allowed me to have access to his copies of the secret peace talks papers, papers on the secret talks that Kissinger forwarded to him. Between those two, I got, I think, the only collection of documents available, because all of the American documents on the secret peace talk have been spirited away by Henry Kissinger. They are nowhere in the files. It's one of the greatest thefts of documents. Kissinger, for his memoirs, you know, really did. The notion that a Frank Snepp, the CIA guy who wrote a book about Vietnam, gets punished to the point where some $200,000 in profits from his book, Decent Interval, which was published, I guess, about 7 years ago, is stripped of that. And Kissinger can publish whatever he wants, declassify whatever he wants, is a staggering one and really upsetting to me. But that's another issue. Anyway, the basic policy in Vietnam from day one was to win. It was not to, as the American people were told, to have a gradual withdrawal of Americans, which did take place, the Vietnamization, and have a decent interval at which time both the South Vietnamese side, which had been bolstered by our training and more equipment, would stand up against the communist side in the South and fight for the future of the country. That was the basic picture we were given of the policy. That all hinged, by the way, on our maintaining Nguyen Van Thieu, the president. We always managed to find fingernail pullers, and he was our fingernail puller for that part of the world. We have others. Pinochet in Chile and the fellow in South Korea. They're pretty good at that too, and in Manila. But this particular fingernail puller somehow got identified with American honor. That was one of the most ludicrous things that happened in the Nixon administration, was that American honor, an honorable settlement to Vietnam, was defined basically as keeping Nguyen Van Thieu in power. This sort of man who had blocked, you know, stopped all first of freedom and rights and independent rights in the South and made the South basically a fascist country, as much of an opposite to democracy as any of the our allies anyway. As I said, the goal was to win. There's nothing wrong with that goal. It's a reasonable one for an American president. Nixon and Kissinger did not tell the American people about it, however, and that was where their trouble began. The first thing they had to do was convey the information to the other side that they were tougher animals, that they were a different breed of cat than Lyndon Johnson, who would bomb and then hesitate, then bomb, and eventually went belly up to the anti-war demonstrators. So they began the secret bombing of Cambodia. In March of 1969, less than 2 months after being in office, Nixon began some 14 months of intensive bombing by B-52 planes of Cambodia, with the B-52 planes being, the pilots being told to report the bombing as having taken place in South Vietnam. Some of your audience, I'm sure, has been to see War Games, and they know how important it is, how much emphasis was made in that movie, paid in that movie, to command and control procedures, the notion of reliability of both humans and machines. And the staggering thing about what they did with the Strategic Air Command is here's this group of pilots that usually ferry around nuclear bombs armed and ready to go. That's their function. They're up in the air right now, ready to go into Russia on a moment's notice and destroy it, begin World War, end, zip, void, be World War void, I think, or null. It would be the end of us all. And one of the things you want to do is ensure yourselves that the men flying those ships don't go crazy, don't do anything on their own. And the notion of a president authorizing this particular group of men to bomb one country and report another without any concern for what it does is staggering to me. This was an item of impeachment, not the aspect I mentioned, but it's, but just a general idea. So he bombs for 14 months. A reporter learns a little bit about it, writes a story in May 1969, a New York Times reporter named Bill Beecher. So he wiretaps in fear that his secret would be known. So he wiretaps for 21 months. The policy, basically, by the summer of 69, was a threat policy. Nixon articulated it in a walk with R.W. Haldeman that he wrote about in his book, The Ends of Power, published about 6 years ago, as the madman theory. The idea being that, as Haldeman wrote, Nixon said, Bob, they were walking along the beach before he became president, I'm going to be irrational. I'm going to just, they're going to make him think I'm going to nuke. The trouble with and that's been, it's been written about a few times, almost lightly. The problem with the madman theory is, or the problem, the fact is that it's a very serious bargaining theory that was lectured upon and discussed repeatedly, for example, at Kissinger's seminars by none other than Daniel Ellsberg, who gave a series of lectures on that theory to Kissinger's seminar at Harvard in 59 and 60, Ellsberg using the Hitler model. This is not to say Nixon was Hitler, but nonetheless, Ellsberg used the Hitler model. Hitler was able to make all this push into Czechoslovakia and everywhere in the middle 30s without firing a gun. I mean, Hitler was so crazy that everybody just laid down their arms rather than fight him. And that was a very interesting theory. Anyway, Nixon understood that theory. And as part of that theory, I write the madman theory. In the fall of 69, by late summer of 69, he had passed an ultimatum to the North Vietnamese through the Romanians, through the Pakistanis, and through the Russians. You guys either give in at the peace table by November the 1st or it's goodbye. It's Gadadamarang. I think I call the chapter Gadadamarang. We're going to hit you like you've never been hit. There were secret studies done without the Secretary of Defense's knowledge. Mr. Laird was cut out. And nuclear options were prepared. Two target folders I describe in great detail in my book. One calling for a nuclear weapon on the Chinese rail line coming down into North Vietnam, obviously from China. And the other one on a very high-volume pass in the Ho Chi Minh Trail called the Mujia Pass, M-U-G-I-A. Mujia Pass was a heavily trafficked infiltration route that we tried to bomb all the time and couldn't stop the North Vietnamese from using it to bring down armaments. We were going to hit that with some sort of nuclear device. We weren't going to necessarily. We just did the option for it. Another aspect of it was to put the Strategic Air Command on the most highest alert possible, which is basically something known as DEFCON 1. Again, all you people who watch War Games. I've never seen it used publicly until I saw that movie the other week. And DEFCON 1 is, it means a preemptive attack, basically. It means we're going to hit the Russians in advance of them hitting us. It means, it really is pretty serious stuff. There's been a lot of debate about whether Hirsch is right in the media about DEFCON 1 with Kissinger and Al Haig and others saying I'm wrong. Let me tell you exactly what happened. We didn't do a normal full DEFCON 1 because that would have involved mobilizing all of American reserves and army and also moving all the ships around. What we did was we put all of the B-52 warplanes on the highest alert, loaded them with live armed nuclear weapons, brought them to the end of the runways and wherever they were located and wherever around the world they were, with motors revving, ready to go, and left them in what they call a stand-down position, ready to take off at a moment's notice with a target, crew ready, sleeping in a shack nearby. This went on for 29 days. As part of the operation, we sent an awful lot of signals into the air that we knew the Russians would intercept, indicating that we'd gone to DEFCON 1, that we'd gone to the highest alert. That's what we did in essence. Is it a full DEFCON 1? Is it not? I'm not sure. I don't think just saying we didn't go to a full DEFCON 1 is a good enough answer. What did we do exactly is something better. And by the way, the person in my book, there's somebody who later became a three-star general who's quoted by name is describing this to me. Got an awful lot of people to give me their names. I think it's because I had so much time. I saw somebody on background, and then 2 years later, I'd call them back, and I'd say, look, why don't we use your name on this quote? And I'd read them the quote, and they'd say, okay. In every case except one. All of this is very scary stuff. All of this we knew nothing about. So comes November the 1st. What happens is, before November the 1st, there's a famous moratorium. A group of former McCarthy, I used to be Jim McCarthy's press secretary in 68, and two young men I work with, Sam Brown and David Mixner, organized a series of moratoriums around the country, large-scale demonstrations. The first one took place October the 13th, 1969 in Washington. 500,000 people showed up. They surrounded the White House with buses. Nixon put out the word that he was at his office working, but in fact, they were terrified. They had evacuation plans ready. They had armed guards, 82nd Airborne men brought up from to line the halls of the White House in case somebody broke in. Kissinger was prepared to sleep in the nuclear bunk, you know, the bomb bunk, a bomb shelter down at the basement of the White House. I mean, really, with a really bunker fortress mentality. So these people are marching against, they've organized and they've come to Washington to protest a policy about which they know very little. What they're protesting is what seemed to be a very slow action by Nixon in his public peace proposals to move very far. Nixon had moved a little bit. He proposed multilateral, mutual is the word, evacuation of both sides, the North and the United States, from South Vietnam. That was our proposal in May of 69, and the North Vietnamese said that has nothing to do with anything. We're not walking out of there. And so what seemed to be a stalemate in the American position and the continuation of the war was being protested by 500,000 people. They did not know the real policy. They were protesting a policy they could not conceive. If they had known that the man had actually put out an ultimatum to the North and was preparing all these plans, I don't know what would happen in this country. Nonetheless, their protests about a policy about which they knew very little so unnerved Nixon, he canceled the November ultimatum. He backed down, and then he turned to the hard hat speech. Look, all I can tell you is I've been a reporter for 25 years. I've written a lot of high, hard ones in my life. I've had a lot of people on my case about a lot of stories, domestic spying, CIA in Chile, Kissinger's wiretapping of his aides. What I've just told you is as true as the fact as I'm sitting here. And I don't know what we're going to do about all this stuff. You know, eventually, I think, there's been an immense amount of press attention to the book, as you know, focused on the first chapter, really, which is the chapter that shows how Kissinger played both sides of the street to get to Nixon. There hasn't been enough attention yet, and I'm not complaining because I'm way ahead of the game in terms of press attention, but we haven't yet got any to a serious criticism or review of what I say about Vietnam policy, because I really think I've got it. I mean, I've got it. And the policy was so different from what we thought it was that it's bewildering.
Well, as a citizen now, you really never know the extent of truth or fiction that you're getting in public addresses and political rhetoric.
You might not, but an awful lot of people think that it's true. Most of the average Americans, if there's such a thing, most of the middle Americans, if there's such a thing, tend to want to believe what they hear. And so if they don't hear bad news, that they think that there is no bad news.
Well, the story that you're talking about now, you were able to get through spending 4 years on dropping everything else and writing
dropping
this book.
Everything else and working this, right.
What role do you think the press could play in day-by-day politics in the country to try to find the discrepancies between what an administration is saying and what they're actually doing?
I think we have to, let's face up to it, which is that I think we have to face the reality, which is that as a guardian of our democracy and as a watchdog against evil doings, we better not put our baskets too heavily into the our eggs into the basket, I guess, whatever the cliche is of the press. It's simply the press is simply, and I include myself, we're just too easily distracted. We have an amiable ignoramus as a president now who we can't really focus on because he's a nice guy. I mean, we're so easily distracted. And it's very hard for somebody covering the president to report honestly. Nobody wants to hear the truth. Truth is always I'm reading right now Harrison Salisbury's memoirs, which concentrate from his early career to some very tough years he spent in the late 40s and early 50s as the Moscow correspondent for the New York Times. And Salisbury really did not like the Soviet mechanism, Stalin. And yet he was writing objectively about it, and occasionally he wrote stories that flew in the face of the American notion of monolithic communism, particularly describing the discrepancy between the policies of the people at the top of the Soviet government and the people, the Soviets, the people, who were much different attitudes. He was painted as a commie and a commie simp. It was really brutal what happened to him. I'm just reading it literally on this afternoon a little while. And, you know, his answer, what he says, is nobody likes to hear the truth. It's very unusual to hear you know, the trouble with us in the press corps is we all spend all of our time writing facts, but we don't write truth. You know, facts are facts, but truth is truth. I don't know how we get around it. I mean, I wasn't taken in very much by Kissinger for sure, but damn, there were times I tell the story here in the underlying point of all this, I'll get back to that story in a second. The underlying point of all this is that it seems clear to me that if the President of the United States wants to lie to the American people, he can get away with it. And it also seems clear to me that we've emerged as in sort of a new role for the presidency in the last post-war, in the last 30, 40 years after World War II. And the new model we have for our president has two basic tenets. One is that the president has sort of a divine right, a King Jamesian right, to conduct any sort of operation involvement in Europe, around the world, in Asia, any place he wants, without much supervision. He can just do it. The second sort of inherent right we've given our presidents and the national security advisors is the right to lie to the press, to the Congress, and to the public about what they're doing. We just give them that right. We have really not extracted enough, it seems to me, in terms of what we want from the top. We simply are tolerant of so much garbage that we're tolerant of. We think people respond to the story I mentioned about Kissinger making offers both to the Democrats and Republicans in 68, the double dealing notion, by saying, well, that's the way politicians are. Well, I don't think we should accept that. I think we should restore morality to this place it belongs. But anyway, let me just tell you the story about myself, because I don't want to think that I wasn't... Everybody gets scared of kicking the press, and I am too. I don't want to overdo it. I don't think we can really fault the press for not doing things that nobody should expect it to do. I have a running feud with Noam Chomsky, who is certainly one of the most brilliant men around, but he keeps on having his heart broken by the press who don't do this and don't do this and don't report on that. And when is he going to, I'm not saying anything I haven't said to him, when is he going to understand that they're never going to do it? And instead of constantly being disappointed, factor that into, don't be disappointed because the press doesn't cover the Middle East war even handily, or et cetera, et cetera. It's not going to.
Is this why you left the New York Times in addition to writing the book?
No. Nothing to do with it. It's just, no. I found my way in the New York Times. I found my way. I'm a great conservative when it comes to facts, and I really believe in facts, and I believe in, because I have strong political views, I believe I'm also a professional journalist. I believe in working much harder than most people if I know there's a truth, to find the truth. And truth basically is truth. And the nice thing about the New York Times, although I get very angry at it often, it is an establishment newspaper, is that if you have the story, you can get it in. I mean, that's always been my fondest. Other people tell me that my experience has been unusual. But I was able to write on 2 days' notice with the story that the CIA had been domestically spying on American citizens illegally and massively so for 8 years by the time I wrote it in 74, for 7 years. And, I didn't leave the New York Times only because of any intellectual disenchantment with the process. The newspaper process is, even given the limits we have in it, it's still there. It's really up to the people in it to do more with it. The story I wanted to tell, to give you an example of how even a tough bird like me can be suckered in by Henry Kissinger, had to do with the Cambodian bombing. Watergate was on in full chase, and we were chasing, and I was always looking for ways to tie the foreign policy and the Watergate. I mean, it's clear that there were, obviously it's related. And one of the first stories I wrote about it was putting Kissinger in the middle of the wiretaps, which certainly I was proud of. And then later I was able to write the first story about the B-52 bombing of Cambodia. Not so much that the bombing took place. Beecher of the Times had mentioned it earlier, but basically that the bombing had been falsely reported and that the Strategic Air Command had been lying in its records, and knowingly so. It's a big story. All over page one of the New York Times. We're talking about June 73. And I call up Kissinger about the second or third day of running with this story, getting the numbers. There were 3,600 missions flown over 14 months, sort of staggering numbers without anybody knowing about it. And Kissinger tells me on the phone he's upset and shocked at the story, and he had no idea there was duplicity or illegalities or false bookkeeping, and it's deplorable, I quoted him as saying. And he's going to authorize and begin an immediate investigation, demand an investigation. I write this story. It's all over page one. And I'm chucking along. Of course there's no investigation, but you never think about it. We're always so ephemeral in the newspaper business. And we're always, you know, writing stories about investigations to begin and never going back to checking. And I start doing this book on The Price of Power, and I get into the B-52 stuff, and I run across the Air Force colonel who set up the illicit reporting procedure, and it turns out that he did so upon direct orders from none other than Henry Kissinger. And he describes, I quote him by name, as describing a meeting in the back of Air Force One, Nixon's plane, in which Kissinger initially wanted not even the pilots to know where they were bombing, let alone keeping it in secret. He wanted to have the pilots bombing targets without knowing where they were bombing. Can you imagine telling Strategic Air Command pilots that you're going to bomb an area you're not to know where it is? I mean, you know, these are the guys that fly nukes. And he'd been involved in nuclear weapons and deterrent policies for years. It's sort of a staggering he's such a great toady, you see, that the president wanted it done, and no matter what the peripheral costs were, he was going to get it done. Because you don't tell the president no. And he blinded himself. Anyway, the point of all this is that much later, when I wrote the story, I had a laugh. I mean, I mentioned this in my book specifically because what contempt he must have had for me, I can't help but think, so somewhat angrily, that, you know, some hotshot this guy is. I just told him, you know, this wonderful, maybe he believes what he said all the time. I don't know how he does it. Maybe he hung up the phone and laughed and uproariously and said, I just sold him a bill of goods. Or maybe at the time he told me he was going to begin an investigation, he really was shocked and was going to begin an investigation. I can't begin to climb inside his psyche, and I don't want to. The fact is that I went for it hook, line, and sinker because it happened to be the story I wanted to write that day. And he has an uncanny knowledge of what we need. An uncanny, he more than anybody else, Henry Kissinger, understands the limits of the American press. And he's one of the few people that is, he from the very beginning underestimated, was one of those who very seriously underestimated our capacity to reason. And he was right. He handled us absolutely, I've always said, his most endearing diplomacies with the press corps. And it's really a classic study of a man understanding, whether instinctively or explicitly, that this is a bunch of guys who really think they're operating somewhere around the A level, and they're really operating around C minus. And I'm going to handle them just like they're C minus, and I'm going to get away with it. I don't think he said it to himself, but certainly that was the impact.
Seymour Hersh is my guest, if you're just joining us, and his new book is called The Price of Power, Kissinger in the Nixon White House. Kissinger is maybe most famous for what's been called shuttle diplomacy, mm-hmm. the way he'd fly from one negotiation right. to another, and you talk about how sometimes he'd have to leave one negotiation in one country at a crucial point to get to the next country where negotiations were about to begin. Do you think that shuttle diplomacy was self-aggrandizing on his
well,
part?
Well, I do talk about it earlier. The shuttle diplomacy began late 73, 74. When my book ends, I should say, in January 73, although I describe his policy exactly as you say it, this sort of flitting in and out. No, I think shuttle diplomacy, I didn't deal with the book, but I certainly looked into it. I just happened to cut my book off at 2,500 pages of manuscript in 4 years. Enough, I drew my hand. I was going to start bleeding internally if I had to do more. No, it wasn't self. But, the trouble with Kissinger in the Middle East is is that the basic, it sounds so petty in a way, and I don't want to take away what he did in the shuttle diplomacy. He worked hard, and he was willing to stay out there and negotiate and force the issue and get everybody to back off. What's upsetting to me about his shuttle diplomacy is what he didn't do earlier. He did not earlier in 71 In 71, you see, there was a terrific chance to make a settlement for disengagement, the same settlement that they began working out in really 74, 75. We didn't complete the settlement. What disengagement wasn't really completed just in the last few years. But Kissinger certainly made a big step in the process. But in 71, an amazing thing, in late 70, Nasser, the president of Egypt, died, and Sadat took over. And by early 71, Sadat was as willing as then as he turned out to be at Camp David, you know, 8 years later with Jimmy Carter, and with Kissinger in 74 and 75, he was willing in early 71 to take a chance for peace. And he was working very closely with a man named Don Burgos, who was a charge d'affaires in Cairo, and also very closely, and I think I can mention his name, I do in the book, with a very, very fine CIA officer named Eugene Trone, who was a station chief in Cairo, and was widely considered the CIA. I'm not surprising you when I tell you that the CIA had some terrific men, particularly in the Middle East, very skilled, very knowledgeable, very dedicated. They weren't all busy running war games. A lot of them were really doing a lot of good intelligence and good sound work. And Trone, to the best that I can find from talking to people, was immensely respected and played a key role in filtering information back and forth. And some people in the desk in the State Department, near Middle East desk, also played a role. I must say Rogers supported them totally, to the point that by this late spring of 71, a disengagement plan was worked out with Sadat that called, by this time there had been this terrible war of attrition between the Israelis and the Egyptians, and we had left with the Sinai as a dividing line, and Egyptian troops on one side, Africa if you will, and the Israeli troops on the other side, you know, the Asia, the continent, on the Middle East on the other side. And the canal was closed, and they were both exposed. And the idea was to peel both sides back. And Moshe Dayan, the late defense minister of Israel, was in favor of it. He was in favor of disengagement for the simple reason that having the Israeli troops exposed out on the Sinai Desert right up to the water, to Suez Canal, right to the shores of the Suez Canal, was useless. I mean, they weren't defensible. So pull back into the foothills. Not clear how far he wanted to pull back, but certainly a considerable length. The deal hinged on also Sadat's willingness, and he was willing to reopen the canal, the shipping, there would be a billion-dollar-plus investment in the canal. And everybody thought, if we can get this damn canal opened up again and ships coming by, we're going to solve the Middle East problems. We're going to solve the problems between Egypt and Israel, because nobody wants to go to war then. Too much economy would be too viable. Sadat also was willing to recognize Israel. I mean, amazing stuff. And what happened is, and I begin my section on the Middle East, which I do not start into well in the book because people won't want to believe it, with the word spite. I say spite played a key role in the Middle East, or a major role. If this had worked, it would have been a big triumph for Rogers, because Nixon and Kissinger had left the Middle East to Rogers. They'd taken everything away from him, but they had to give him something. He wasn't in full control, but they left him with seeming control. He was allowed to go to the Middle East. He was allowed to run negotiations. And how much he was on top of this, I don't know. That isn't the issue. He was obviously working through AIDS. The fact is that Kissinger sabotaged it. And I described that process very thoroughly in my book. He just absolutely, he would not have a big victory for Rogers before there were any major victories for either he or Nixon in foreign policy. That's a terrible indictment. And he would argue that it was impossible then for a number of reasons, that maybe the Israelis wouldn't have gone along, and that's fair. Maybe they wouldn't have. We don't know. But, and geopolitically it was impossible. But the fact is he sabotages. So what happens after he sabotages it? We know from the memoirs of Mohammad Haikal, who was close to Sadat then, and also from Mahmoud Riyad, who was the foreign minister, very interesting memoirs, and also from my own interviews with various Egyptians, that Sadat began saying, after this fell through in the summer of 71, he began saying, these Americans are crazy. There's nothing you can do with them. They don't accept us as men. We're going to have to prove we're men, which meant we're going to have to go to war to prove we're men. I'm not laying the 73 war to Kissinger. I can't. But you also can't separate out the role, the failure of American diplomacy to take advantage of Sadat's initiatives in 71. You can't. Why were they suddenly so valuable in 73, 74? The same sort of ideas that were rebuffed in 71. And the only answer, it seems to me, is this, that Kissinger was now in control and it was something for which he could get credit. It's a terrible thing to say about anybody.
Let me just quote something you say in the book about Kissinger as a negotiator. You said that the South Vietnamese leadership had become more suspicious of Kissinger, and he was seen as an enemy of the state, as a man whose contempt for Asians was acute, and as a negotiator desperately eager to sell a bad bargain. Do you think that that perception of him applied to other countries too? That
he was
seen as being racist and anxious to sell a bad bargain?
There's no question. I think that the Chinese understood Kissinger. They understood his anxiety to work out a deal. And the Chinese, I think the Chinese absolutely, and they've told others, Zhou Enlai has told others how they were able to play in Kissinger's vanity. I described some of that. There's also no question that in 71, Kissinger, for example, tried to negotiate. In 71, before there had been any breakthroughs, May 71, at this time, May 71, Nixon hadn't accomplished anything. He hadn't accomplished China and he hadn't accomplished anything in foreign policy. The Vietnam War was still going. And the Russians had agreed in May of 71 to a breakthrough on the SALT talks. They would drop one of their requirements that would enable us to go forward with the SALT agreement. The Russians' forward-based systems, I'll just throw out the word so people know that I'm just deliberately not getting into it, but a complicated requirement. And that paved the way for an agreement. The price for this was a commitment from Nixon to sell grain, more than $1 billion worth of American grain. The Soviets had tremendous shortfalls in their grain crops because of heavy rain. And also very low American interest. We would underwrite the sales with the low interest loans, 6%, none of which was made public, by the way. Nixon and Kissinger have denied this repeatedly. In order to pull this off, however, the sale of Soviet grain, the grain would have to be shipped in Soviet merchant vessels, and would have to be loaded by the International Longshoremen's Unions. Nick Kissinger called in a group of the unions, the union leaders, in June 71. And some wonderful stuff emerged out of it because, as Paul Hall, one of the union leaders, later told an aide, and this is all quoted directly, he was trying to punk us. He was like a federal mediator. He just wanted to score a bargain. The notion that he was widely perceived as somebody who wanted to make a score, that his basic interest was in getting a settlement, not in trying to work out equitable terms, but in making a score. And I think it's impossible for me to believe that the Russians and Chinese didn't understand the advantage they had in having a Nixon come to Peking in 72 and a Nixon come to Moscow in 72 needing a bargain, an election year.
I know that you've read Kissinger's memoirs probably many, many times over. What are some of the real highlights of how his telling of the story compares to yours?
Well, a classic one would be his description of how he got to Nixon, which is one of my favorite stories. He and Nixon have worked out this wonderful sort of scenario where he got to Nixon on this basis, that Nixon had read his works, a dubious proposition, by the way. Nixon had read his works on nuclear policy and planning and had admired them. And they had met once at a party at Claire Booth Luce House in New York. And then he'd called him up. And his name was brought into the campaign by Nelson Rockefeller, Kissinger's benefactor and mentor, had mentioned, why don't you talk to Henry? And he talked to him. And they got along so brilliantly that it was agreed that he would go to work. That's the story, the cover story. The real story, of course, is that Kissinger had double-dealed his way into the White House, had betrayed the peace talks for which he'd been a consultant. Kissinger is competent. Oh, God, let me say that. He's a very bright guy, very competent. And he certainly did a lot of good work for the Johnson administration on the peace talks. I haven't looked into the work. Maybe it's as much of a canard as the rest of the stuff. But it seems from the Pentagon Papers and from what others have told me, Paul Warnke and Clark Clifford and others, that he was certainly very, very much respected for having played a role in the peace process in 66 and 67 and not talked about it. So in 68, he suddenly shows up in Paris at the time of a breakthrough in the peace talks when Johnson and the North Vietnamese had worked out some sort of, I guess the word is, modalities for a bombing halt. By the way, you know what the issue was? We were ready to stop bombing. Johnson wanted to stop bombing to elect Humphrey, but he wanted a guarantee of reciprocity from the North Vietnamese in advance. The North Vietnamese said, you stop the bombing and then we'll do something. That was the issue. It's like little boys with sticks in the dirt, you know. You get a sense of this machismo business that Jack Kennedy was a great expert on. I mean, Gary Will's book is Imprisonment of Nixon's, what is it, Kennedy's Imprisonment is a wonderful book for that. The whole notion of these little boys playing at war games, you know, I'll stop the bombing, but not until I know you're going to do something. And the other side saying, you stop the bombing and then we'll do it. We don't want to make a commitment until you stop the bombing. Anyway, we don't have 6 years to talk about all this, but again, we talk about Central America. You have to think about it in terms of little boys drawing lines in the sticks.
Are you assuming that there are discrepancies between the truth and presentation as great in the current administration as there were in the Nixon administration?
I don't think we'll ever see discrepancies as great. I mean, you know, I've told you about a Vietnam policy that led 500,000 people to protest a policy that didn't exist. I mean, I don't think we'll see it that badly. I think this administration whether you like them or not, you have to acknowledge that they are more upfront about what they're doing. Ronald Reagan is more upfront about what he's doing. The trouble is a lot of people didn't listen to him in the beginning. He really, you know, he does believe in godless communism. There's something to be said for a president who does believe in it. I don't think it's it doesn't endear him to me, but at least we have a better idea. I would still say, however, there's a tremendous discrepancy between what actually is going on down there and what we're being told. I think more is going down. I think there are more Pentagon troops there than CIA. I think that's an area that people don't realize. They're sending more covert military units in. In other words, not all the military men are overt. They're covert. But if they're defense, it's a little easier to hide them than if they're CIA these days. CIA is so hot. I would speculate that. And also I would say that there's the bottom line we have no illusions about, but it's clear that I would think it's clear that most people should recognize that the goal is to overthrow the Sandinista regime. And that seems to be the more or less spoken by now goal. But there is certainly in the early years, there was 81 and part of 82, there was a great deal of duplicity about what he wanted to do. You know, nobody had any idea that was his ultimate goal. There always is. In Nixon and Kissinger, it just was more acute because there is no Kissinger-like fixture in this administration that can wave his magic wand over the press. They can't quite get away as much with the press.
Would you be able to describe it all? How you contact people and interview them in such a way so that they will tell you things that perhaps they wouldn't tell other people, and then 2 years later be willing to go on the record about it?
Hustle. I use the word hustle. And what I do is I work very hard. I read hearings, congressional hearings. I read books. You know, a lot of reporters write but don't read. I read a lot. It's to my advantage. I think all of the basically... a lousy reporting in my book, but I don't mean lousy. What they reported is fine, but there's all these things I talk about I have not been really reported yet. And I know if I were a reporter working for the New York Times or elsewhere, I would have been all over this book. I wouldn't have just written the stories. I would have called the sources and tried to get them, make them better. You know what I mean? And I see such a lack of that the market's still there. I mean, you know, for somebody who wants to work very hard and really be energetic about what he's doing. And I'm also a moralist. I mean, I believe in things. And I think that drives me. I believe from covering the Vietnam War that it was an immoral, dishonorable act. And that the you know, I knew from my work with My Lai, I knew that if I'd been 17 and recruited into the army and working for Lieutenant Calley in that crazy village, in that crazy war, and somebody said, shoot, I don't know if I wouldn't have done what they did. I don't know if I would have. I certainly don't think I would have turned them in. I mean, that would have been the last thing I would have done. I might have stood aside. So the people who do the shooting become as much victims as the people they shoot. And I felt that very strongly. And I really was very angry at Nixon and Kissinger for not responding to what was appropriate in the war and continuing it and devising. I hold Kissinger to a higher standard too on this, because I happen to know now that I've done my book, I can say this. I know he believed that the war could not be won with Win Van Two, and that it was hopeless. I know he believed that, or at least he told you can't say anything about what he believes. At least he told that to a number of people in 66 and 67 at a time when he wasn't suspecting he would be in government. Maybe dreaming it, but not suspecting it was going to be reality. And so I tend to believe that stuff more. And then to get into the White House and just do whatever Nixon wanted, you know, that's a high price. But anyway, the point is, in the case of this book, having enough money to do a travel around the world, get the documents, the case I cite is Richard V. Allen, who was Reagan's foreign policy guy, who was also Nixon's foreign policy advisor in 68. He ended up working for Reagan in 70. He's the fellow that took had $1,000 in his safe. Allen turns out to be okay. We reporters always say that about people that talk to us, but he really is okay. And that whole $1,000 incident has a lot of murkiness in it. I don't think he was selling a soul for $1,000. I mean, that's the least. That's the one possibility that didn't exist. That doesn't mean that there wasn't a certain amount of carelessness in it. But anyway, he turns out to be okay. I disagree with him on every issue possible, but he doesn't lie to me about certain things. And after the third or fourth interview, Alan did express amazement that I knew so much about the physical location. I was worried about whose office is where and down the hall. I was doing all that stuff, sort of flow charts. And he finally said on the third or fourth visit, when he saw I was really working stuff and coming back to him and saying, so-and-so said this about what you said, he finally said, look, I'm going to tell you how Kissinger got to us. And then he proceeded to tell about this incredible call he got in September when Kissinger, calling from Paris, said, there's been a breakthrough. Do you want me to tell you about it? I'll do it if you promise not to tell a soul, and also, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And Kissinger began his betrayal working with Allen. And I think I got that story because of Hustle. And once you get one story, they pyramid.
I hate to ask you this in so little time, but I do want a chance to ask it to you. What do you think of objectivity, which is a very sanctified notion in the press? Now, you've been an investigative reporter for a long time. You have
nobody's objective
strong political beliefs.
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was clear to me from covering the Pentagon after about 3 months on-the-job training that the Vietnam War was a disaster, that it was a moral disaster, that it was killing our boys, and that it was ruining the armed services. You had to be a professional liar to make colonel. And it was, you know, that was my belief. All that did was make me be very much more careful in the way I covered McNamara. I used to cover McNamara's news conferences. I had no problem going in and covering a news conference with McNamara and running out and doing my job, which is reporting it like anybody from Tanzug or Hinshaw or the Cuban press agency would. You know, propaganda, but straight. That's the way the AP wants it. I can do that. And I don't think, you know, I'm really amused by this notion that reporters don't have any First Amendment rights. Look, the way I cope with my lack of objectivity, you might say, or my passions about certain things is I pick different targets than other people would. When I worked at the New York Times, I shared office space. Next door to my office was Drew Middleton, who's more or less a conservative, pro-military guy. And I respected Drew for doing what he did, which was he had his views, he called up his generals and his people, and he got his stories. I love that because it made me free to do my reporting. And, you know, I could do what I want. And I don't think as – I think what it does, my strong feelings makes me work harder to get the facts. But I think when it comes to talking about my book and people start asking about my motives, I say right away, hey, what's that got to do with anything? I've written 700 pages there. Judge the book. Don't worry about what I say or think or talk about. That's not relevant. What's relevant is whether or not what I write is accurate and worth doing something about. And that, to me, is the final standard.